Welcome to Environment Deep Dive, a series from the Civil Service Environment Network. Through this series, we aim to explain and explore the biggest issues in environmental policy, talking to experts on topics across climate change, sustainable development, natural resources, and biodiversity and ecosystems.
My name's Nadine from the CSUN Network, and I'm joined by guest Vijay Rangarajan. So Vijay is Director General working on Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Overseas Territory, the Middle East and North Africa. He also leads the FCDO's work on energy, climate and the environment. So hi Vijay, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
No worries. So your current workload looks quite full and varied, and your career up to date is involved working on a variety of countries around the world. So that all looks quite busy, but before we get into your career, can you give us an insight into who you are and what kind of things you enjoy outside of work?
Yeah, it's busy. I can tell. I'm thinking at the moment we're going through so many crises and we always do. But yeah, even the busiest, I think it's really important, and this is obviously a lesson we all learn, to have things outside that keeps us a bit saner than we otherwise be. Minus cycling, I bike every day, trying to do a long bike ride at weekends. That's really good, just trying to stay vaguely fit, which is a struggle at times. Love cooking, eat too much, drink too much, like wine. And when I have a chance, I'd like to read really, I'm science fiction, I always have been, and really, really enjoy that. And the thing I love doing, don't do enough of at all, is any kind of water sports. But when I was in Brazil, I was host in Brazil just before this, I got deeply into windsurfing. So that's my kind of primary passion. If I was going to be doing something else, I'd be underwater, falling off my board at high speeds. That's the best thing to do.
You'd be a champion windsurfer, I'm sure.
No, I'm a very bad windsurfer, but I just like doing it.
Yeah. No, fab. Yeah. So you talked about working in lots of different countries. So could you give me or us a quick overview of your career to date? It does look quite varied and interesting.
Yeah, like most civil servants, I think I've dotted around a lot and done all sorts of things depending on what the world and government throws at us. As I started, I was a physicist by background, a mathematician, then joined the FCDO, or the FCO as then was, slightly unexpectedly, actually. And ended up getting into European policy in my first few jobs, which was utterly fascinating. And that really gave me a bug for negotiating for multilateral diplomacy, which some people love it, some people hate it, but I adored it, really did. So then went to my first big posting was Brussels for a while in Accra, which was really interesting because it gave a real sense of some of the global issues. It was just the beginnings. This is sort of early 2000s of a lot of thinking and work on climate change. It was just really the international systems were beginning to get up to a high political level on that, but nothing like we see now. After that, I went to Mexico, which was fantastic back in London, Mexico, as deputy ambassador. Then back to Brussels again, doing just the same affair. So I was working for many different government departments. At that point, it was MOJ and Home Office and various others. And then back into FCO on UN and then Europe. And so I was doing Europe, there was Europe director for the FCO in the 2014-15-16 period, which, as you can remember, was quite intense. Then I went off to Brazil, which was fantastic. I had 3.5 years in Brazil as ambassador. Not easy, but that was when I got really deep into, obviously, the climate and environment work. It was a very big part of what we're doing, and a hugely important part, and a part which was partly with the government and with local governments, and part of seeing because the Bolsonaro government had a very different view to us on a lot of climate and deforestation in particular. So it was quite tough arguing as well. And so with colleagues like my German and Norwegian colleagues, we did a lot of work on that. And then came back into this job at the creation of FCDO in 2020, and then was leading with COP unit the work on COP26, which was quite a massive thing to do. We'll probably get into that in more detail. And then did COP27, and I'm now in the final bits preparing for COP28.
Wow, thank you. Yeah, that does sound very varied, and it sounds like quite a good basis for working in COPs as well. All that negotiation, the input on climate as well. So, yeah, you said you enjoy negotiation, and that's something that I'm sure lots of people don't. So what do you think is really needed in that space when you're debating with countries and you've got different views on topics?
First of all, you've got to master the detail. You've got to know what you're talking about. If you don't, you're toast, because others will, and other people make it their absolute business to know what they're talking about. So I've never had very much truck or sympathy with this idea that, you know, if you're negotiating with a diplomat, somehow you can float free of the detail. And that's not what working, to be honest, in any of the European institutions or negotiations teaches you. It's really what you're doing. The other thing is have masses of sympathy for your negotiating opposites, and they become colleagues and friends. You may not agree, you may not agree on anything, but no negotiation, I think, is made worse by really bad interpersonal relations. So getting to know them, getting to know why they're arguing, where they're arguing, what's driving them. And then it helps you to sort of look behind them and think, well, actually, their problem is this position or this vested interest or this minister or whatever it is. Try and change that. And the other thing is just keep a really strong sense of strategy out of all of this. I think some negotiations that don't work are ones where you pay a short-term price or you even get a short-term gain and actually lose a long battle in the argument because people don't end up agreeing and enough people don't agree. You just lose all the sympathy. At that point, your deal is fragile because someone will come back in the future. So keeping that real sense of what's a sustainable long-term deal that works is pretty crucial.
Mm. Yeah, no, it sounds super interesting. So you need to keep a kind of high-level view of the long-term goals when you're negotiating then, and not just focus on the short-term.
And that's what makes the climate stuff so fascinating and really challenging, right? So the long-term goals can be fairly clear, but they're big and they're long-term. But the mastery of this enormous amount of detail, so nobody can master, I think, all the detail of the climate world. So we've very much divvied up and thought, we're good at this. We do the structures well in terms of the negotiations. But with climate and environment work now, it is so big, so whole of economy, whole of society, whole of world. It's a different kind of negotiation, which are actually negotiated, but there's so much else going on. So I think there's a different challenge there, which is when people say, what are you doing on climate? Well, it sort of depends on which area. There's a huge bit of finance. There's a huge bit on mitigation. And then you drill down, just on mitigation, every country is doing a different thing. Every company is doing something different. Each technology is moving. Each sector is moving. So what do you do on mining? So mining, then you look into that and think, every company is doing something different. So what do you mean on steel mining? And so you have the iron ore mining, steel production. You have to then, I think, part of our challenge, but also the opportunity here is identify the place that you can make a really major difference. And so that's a bit what I think in my current job we spend our time doing, and certainly did before COP 26, 27, and now 28. So where is it in that enormous set of areas? Whether there's a gap, or an opportunity, or a UK advantage or technology or whatever it is that we can then step into and say, right, we can really accelerate that process. The other thing different about the climate negotiation, I think, is speed matters. Oh, I think we're all going to see, and we'll come to this at COP28, the rate of change of climate is faster than we had thought, borne out by the recent IPCC reports and it's on your news screens every day. So that sense of the keeping and helping the rest of the world and helping the UK adapt as quickly as is needed to meet what are really stretching targets is important. So again, trying to do so in the most economically, politically sensible way that keeps up the speed. So it's a different negotiation, this one, in many ways.
Mm. Yeah. So do you see this COP being slightly different from previous ones? Do you always have a different strategy going in?
So COP26 was quite special because we were running it, and that was a good bit. And it was in Glasgow, which was fantastic. And it was in COVID, which was, believe me, not fantastic. If I've ever got one lesson to anybody, is do not try to organize, 40, 50, 60, 70,000 person in-person event in the middle of a global pandemic, which caused us difficulties beyond belief. At that time, I was also running the FCDO's global health work. So that was all the vaccines and to do with COVID. So putting those together, that was a real stretch. You know, what kind of vaccination, at what level, when? I remember this was, you know, fairly early into the COVID pandemic, so we weren't as practiced or knew as much as we do now. There were some really difficult risk management questions there, which I'm sure anyone who's listened to this who's been with health world will probably be shivering at the memory of what we were going through doing that. So COP26 was really quite different. It was also a very big COP. COPs, they're different sizes. Every 5 years, there's a biggie. This was a biggie. Partly because of what had happened before, which had been a couple of less successful COPs. So we knew we had to do some really major things in the negotiation itself. But very deliberately, what ministers decided to do was to make it extremely broad spectrum. You know, we had a huge thing on finance. Remember, Mark Carney and others, the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, huge amounts of private sector finance input. We did huge amounts on nature. The first time it had been given, I think, quite that amount of prominence and an oomph. We did lots on technology. We did a lot on climate and issues. So things like climate and gender, climate and health, climate and education, all of these are really cool when you come to think about them. I mean, just take health. Health systems, I think, 8% of around that, well, some will correct me, of global emissions. So we've got to make health systems decarbonize. Not easy. And we've also got to make health systems adapt to climate changes. So the kind of combination of mitigation and an adaptation issue there. And if you're building health systems anywhere in the world, from really basic primary systems in Southeast Asia or Sub-Saharan Africa, right the way through to whatever state-of-the-art system we have, there will be a climate impact of what's going on. Be it in the diseases that we see, we're already seeing diseases spreading in different ways, simply because of changing temperatures. But right the way through to just non-communicable diseases caused by heat or dehydration or many other things which are going on. And so again, if you draw that into that, opening the very broad space of what does climate mean has meant, I think, COP27 and COP28. Are looking at some of these things in more detail. And we started whole processes, like on climate and health, which have now got a life of their own, which is great, and are continuing. And essentially each COP is going to come along and take stock of those. So COP27 was obviously Egypt, in Sharm el-Sheikh, and that was really a lot of things on finance. We had not met the 100 billion target by then and heard that really loud and clear. Loss and damage became a really big issue, really interesting on climate and health, and a general sense that things had to accelerate. This COP28, I think, again, is going to be part the same, which is good, and part different. So I think this time around we're going to have what's called the first ever global stock take. So this is when we actually say, are we on track for 1.5 degrees? The short answer is no, we're not, right? So that's going to come through loud and clear. So then the question becomes for all the people who are there, so what are we going to do about it? And that's where the negotiation starts. And what we've obviously been doing is helping countries around the world, persuading countries to update their NDCs, their National Determined Contributions. That's crucial because that's the kind of baseline from which all the climate calculations follow. And then, can we bring the finance and the technical expertise and whatever is needed to help countries actually meet all their NDCs? And in some cases, actually, countries are exceeding their NDCs, which is great. So can they then recommit and increase their commitments if they can, which again helps that sense of urgency and building momentum, sharing best practice, technologies, money, whatever it is that is needed. Again, very whole of the economy, very whole of society. One thing I think COP28 is going to be very interesting on, we'll do a lot on adaptation, the global climate adaptation. There'll be probably get somewhere on a global goal on adaptation. And in many ways, when people think about climate, they think about mitigation. So, you know, it's very personalized. What is my carbon footprint? Or 1.5 degrees. You know, there are really clear carbon budget. You know, there are clear things here which people know they understand the concept. And climate adaptation is behind on that. We've got to get more as we're seeing the inexorable set of effects coming in. So, you know, when people are thinking about the really retail decisions, are they taking climate into account if it's in government, any infrastructure, policies, or even just personally? So, you know, you're going to put a new roof on your house every 30, 40 years. The next time you put a roof on your house, probably a good idea to look ahead and think, oh, maybe a little bit steeper to cope with either the rainfall. The gutters probably have to be a bit bigger if you're in a place where rainfall is going to go up over the next 40 years. Equally, if you're in a place where suddenly we expect and the climate modeling is really good, it's going to get drier. There are places in the world which are also going to get drier and hotter. You're really going to want to think about your water use. You're going to want to think about the systems you put in. Now, none of this is cheap, but as long as it's done at the same time as upgrades in other areas, you know, when you do your roof, put on a more climate-adaptive roof, rather than take off a perfectly good roof and put on a new one, you can push a lot of the cost into just normal infrastructure upgrades. So how do we really get adaptation, I think, retail and built into all of our systems? Everything from insurance. Hopefully, insurance companies would charge us less if you're climate adaptive, and we're certainly seeing that in agriculture, for example, in some areas. So that's going to be really interesting, I think, on adaptation. And then the final bit is this is the first COP where big energy companies are going to have a much more prominent role, and that's been really politically sensitive. And this is a bit of going back to what I said at the beginning. It's a whole of society, whole of economy, whole of world set of changes we now need. And the energy companies are absolutely crucial in this. If they do not support and enable decarbonisation of all of our energy systems, we're not going to make net zero. So getting them in, clearly they also produce an enormous amount of carbon, either in their own immediate emissions, scope one, or the kind of broader scope two emissions that they produce, or the emissions of their customers in scope three. And I think the big argument going to COP 28 on this is going to be what kind of commitments can they make consistent with net zero. And so that's the first time that's happening. And I'm glad that the UAE are expanding that because it's going to be a crucial part of the solution.
Fab, thanks so much. Yeah, that's a really great overview of how different those COPs are as well. I mean, you get a sense when watching the outputs from the news that they're quite tense negotiations sometimes. You see the outcomes, but how is it for you on a kind of day-to-day basis when you're there?
That's quite mad. I mean, they are quite something. It's sort of, for those who haven't done it, it's like a sort of UN General Assembly, but 100 times bigger. It's sort of, in a way, it's diplomatic speed dating because there's everything. There. But there's also these hardcore chunks of things that have to happen. So there's the hardcore of the negotiations themselves, the texts that governments are agreeing they're going to do. And I can obviously, if we saw at COP26 at the end, it comes down sometimes to individual words. But behind those individual words lies huge amounts of what are we all committing to and why and can we justify it and how does our own, in every country, how does our own domestic politics work and how do we actually make sure we can do this? So there is a hard part of negotiation. There's then a really interesting part outside negotiating rooms, which is about what businesses are doing. And I think what we're seeing, and certainly COP26 was enormously bigger on the private sector business finance front. So many businesses are doing so many interesting things and making their own commitments. For good commercial reason, that the sharing between them and the aspirations they're all setting, both for themselves and their competitors, and the expectation they have, I think, that consumers often will be taking into account the environmental impact of those companies and what they say and what they buy. So there's a really strong competitive pressure on this. And so that element of the private sector is really strong now in COPs. And the final thing is a kind of combination of technology and economics. I mean, I've just been blown away over the last few years by how much simple things like the cost, the levelized cost of energy from solar panels. And when you just compare that to other basic, you know, overall cost of energy, including the capital at the beginning, including running costs. Solar is now so cheap. Well, that's not helped by the fact that we've obviously just been through yet another energy shock with Russia's invasion of Ukraine and all of the oil and gas consequences of that, which has been remarkable that we've managed to reorient our entire energy systems, certainly in the UK and Europe, to the point that this winter we're going in with record gas stocks into this winter. Great. But underlying all of that, you know, while we still rely on fossil fuels, we are seeing enormous investments in renewables now. And it's not because governments are telling companies to, it's because they produce really cheap energy. So I think there's a lot of zen. How do we take those economic changes and implement them in our own country? So things like the work that's going on reforming the UK and the European electricity markets, that's going to be really important. Or how do we make sure our grids stand up? And countries across the world have problems on grids. It was just come back about a month ago from a fascinating trip to China, where I was talking about hydrogen and grids and energy supply in general and decarbonization and offshore wind in Beijing, and then going to a gigantic green energy conference in Suzhou in the south. Now, the scale of what the Chinese are doing is remarkable, and obviously they produce a huge amount of solar panels, for example, that we use. But they've still got real challenges on grids, and so the Japanese, which are then around after that. So we share these challenges, and everyone's trying to figure out what's the most effective, cost-effective way of actually tackling them. So really interesting to then share, and that's why I think that private sector overall technological discussions of COPs are crucial. And then finally, the thing that COPs have really become is also a very political, very social, civil society power base. It was fantastic at COP26 to go around and see all the groups who were there, some demonstrating, some protesting, some in support, many doing all the events. But that's the domestic political pressure that governments are under, which we all understand. And to be honest, it was one of the things that we did harness really well at COP26 to say, governments, you need to agree this because look at the people behind you, your voters, and certainly your future voters, who are really, really strong on this. And that's a very traditional diplomatic task. When I was talking about negotiating and everything, you've got to look behind your negotiator. That's the sort of thing that we will certainly do in COP26. Actually, just going around and, you know, running through the pavilions, seeing the events on, I'm always just struck. You see them, my God, they're doing that, are they? And countries around the world are doing things which are utterly remarkable. The Nepalese are doing amazing stuff on how do you protect communities from the melting that they're seeing up in the Himalayas. And landslides coming. The Bangladesh is doing amazing stuff on how do you, very low-lying country, how do you cope with sea level rise and water change? Literally around the world, you're seeing incredible examples, which obviously part of our role is hoover those up and how we apply those in the UK and feed those back to relevant, hopefully people listening to this can have heard some of those great examples and can bring them to life in the UK.
Perfect. Yeah. Right at the end, we'll ask you for a call to civil servants so you can push that out and ask people what exactly you want them to do. But yeah, that sounds great. And it's fab if you can get examples around the world and we can bring them to the UK and bring them on board and build on what all the other countries have worked on already. That's really good. And you were talking about people protesting and we've seen the kind of awareness of a climate environment increasing in recent years. So does that have a focus on your negotiation as well? Are you aware of protesters outside and do you kind of work extra hard?
So I think most of us, and this is probably the case for all civil servants, but you know that your work has a real domestic and real importance and a real salience. When you hear someone protesting outside of what you're doing, you really know it. You know, it's not like they're just writing letters or writing to MP or giving vox pops to the media, but they're taking the trouble to come and actually protest and give their views, and many of them know a huge amount. So I made a point in and this is just really interesting as well, in COP 26 and 27, was there's a thing called the Blue Zone, which is kind of where all the governments and negotiators hang out. And as much as I love them all dearly, it's really nice to get outside it. It can get very bubbled inside there. And go and talk to other protesters, go and wander around and see what's going on, which the technology zones and some of the other enterprise zones outside the Blue Zone. So really good to get out and take advantage of all of that COP. And you do get a really strong sense. You know, people say this is really politically salient, but one of the things that utterly inspiring was at COP 27, I think it was the first time, there was a youth pavilion right in the middle. And I wandered there regularly, actually, because it was brilliant fun. They were putting on incredible events and talks, but there were a lot of unbelievably passionate and knowledgeable young people there. And you can get a lot of energy and a lot of impetus, you know, after you've been working for 10 days on the trot, and it basically hasn't stopped for about 15, 20 hours a day. Something like that does give you a little boost, and you can think, right, I'm going to go back in again and have another go at whatever it is, however difficult it is. And just saying, COPs are not easy places for everyone. By about end of the first week, everyone's got a cold. Everyone's knackered. They've all got a cold because you basically can't get the number of people together in the world without someone bringing in a nice different variant of cold, and everyone's tired and jet lagged. So you do need a lot of energy to get through it. And there's a certain camaraderie, I think, that comes the kind of the survivors at the end or getting near the end of a COP like that.
Yeah, I bet there's a good celebration at the end. Is there, or is everybody just so exhausted that kind of collapse in a heap?
Yeah, I'm not sure there's a celebration. I think particularly the people at the bitter end, the negotiators, they are either collapsing in a heap. I imagine there are some celebrations, but there's no kind of great end of COP party, I'm afraid. It's a little bit strange. They start off with a World Leaders Summit, usually the first couple of days, where heads of state and government come in, give speeches, set the tone for what they think is needed, a really important sort of political foundation to build on. And then you get through a series of theme days where each of these issues is explored. So the one on, say, health or education or equality or many different ways, and that's what the COP presidency can organise. And then the negotiators are sort of quietly beaving away in their rooms during all of this and getting more and more important until it ends in, you know, what's the decision text at the end, and that's the kind of negotiators' movement to bring it all together. But by then, a lot of people in those theme days and all the leaders are basically gone. So it's a weird old dynamic for a COP like that.
Yeah, I expect the relief or the enjoyment in what you've all achieved comes a bit later when you start putting those into practice.
Yeah, and to be honest, I think it's always very tempered. I think anyone who's involved in this thinks we are doing enough. In fact, the global stocktake's not on track. And we're all trying to accelerate this and get things to change. You always have a slight feeling that, you know, we could have gone further. It was there more that could have been done. Who is not taking on whatever part of which burden is needed? You know, who's deciding that they're going to still start funding fossil fuels or coal, or they're going to not sign up for deforestation commitment or something like that? So I don't think you don't end up any of these ever thinking, oh, well, that was all great. We got to what we needed, because there's just always so much more that will need to be done. We're all looking ahead. It's 2023 now. It's actually, in any transition to the timing of this magnitude, 2050 is not a long way away. Now, the techniques that were developed in the UK, the carbon budget system, the Climate Change Act, and so on, they are really powerful. I think we've done well, and many other countries have looked at what we've done, and we're doing very similar as to how do you actually try and manage this transition, again, in the most, you know, cost-effective economic way, because nobody's either wants or thinks that we, I think some people would think we're going to be poorer if we do this, but I don't think that's what the economics says. There are enormous opportunities, which I'm sure everyone on this knows, in the energy transition itself, and how do we take full advantage of those in the decarbonisation and adaptation journey. But it's not long, And so speed and dealing with the uncertainties involved is really difficult. And so it's a very, very major set of policy challenges.
Yeah, so we are halfway to from the Paris Agreement, so from 2015 to the targets in 2030, and that's only 7 years to go. So you said that the targets are, I don't know, they're quite hard to achieve. How achievable do you think we are going to hit them?
So I think they're achievable, put it that way. I think 2015, they're totally achievable. I'm getting enormous heart by the technology side in particular. Nobody expected, I think, the rate of reduction of solar energy to fall as low and as fast and steadily. I mean, it's been an exponential. You put on a log graph and you can turn on the mathematician, and it's still remaining a remarkable straight line. And it's not showing signs of tailing off. And my favorite stat on this, which I hope is not a kind of slight misleading factor, but I think it's absolutely right, is it costs less to install new solar to produce X amount of electricity than to just buy the gas needed to run an existing plant to produce the same amount of electricity. So, and of course, once you bought that solar, it continues on for a long time to produce. So there is a real revolution, I think, in the way that we do it. The UK obviously has pioneered the way on offshore wind. I mean, look at the North Sea. The rest of the world hasn't yet installed anything like the amount of offshore wind that that they can. And you can think of, you know, plenty of countries. The one I know very well is Brazil, which is now working really hard on their enormous great northeast coast to put in offshore wind. When they do that, and believe me, as a wind surfer, they have some wonderful wind there. They will produce an enormous amount of electricity. They can do lots of things with electricity. They can do domestically. They're able to produce, you know, ammonia or hydrogen for storage and so on. And that's the same around the world. I think all of these, if we can get them in that scale, I think there is a very good chance we can meet the targets that we've set. Deep into our economies, there are sectors that are much harder to abate. So, you know, agriculture, really difficult to get significant levels, and that's one of the harder to abate sectors, I think. But there are some really great technologies there, which people have developed and are implementing. You can buy a hunk of beef, which is very high carbon, probably the highest carbon thing you can eat, very high deforestation, and produced in really bad conditions for the people and the farmers and those who trade it. You can buy an equivalent hunk of beef, and I have, and it was delicious, which is basically zero carbon, zero deforestation, produced with all the ESG standards. So, you know, we are talking about how do we incentivize worldwide all of those agricultural systems to change, all the mining systems to change, shipping, aviation, you know, you name it, and then, of course, our own transport with electric cars and so on. Household heating, very big issue. Heat pumps clearly do some amazing things now. And again, that technology continues to improve. So you put all those together, the challenge is less a technological one. It's more a speed of change, economic investment sort of challenge. And that is, governments can do a lot there in terms of both incentives and regulation. And that around the world, I think, is the sort of discussion that we're having.
Thank you. Yeah, so I know that this year's COP has themes around technology and innovation, but it also covers inclusion of frontline communities and finance. So do you have any further information about any of those or what the UK's position?
I can cover more of the technology and the finance. The finance is going to be interesting. I think this year, the good news is we're going to have net 100 billion commitment. That's what it looks like. That's important. It's the absolutely key signal that the developed world is helping the developing world in this really difficult journey. But it's nowhere near enough. And I think some of the discussions we're having on what you may have heard of as the Bridgetown agenda. So how do we get enough finance into developing countries so that they can go on their own energy transition? Now, the G7's got things sort of this. It is acronym soup when you get into the climate world, you know, but these things called JETPs, the Joint Energy Transition Partnerships. And we've put billions When people wonder where does our interest on climate finance go, quite a lot of it is going into these jet fees. For example, a really big one in South Africa. Now, and this one's fascinating. And we had a very large role in leading this and setting it up. But it's a lot of money, I think it's about $7-8 billion, to take and support the South African energy firm, Eskom, from basically being a coal user to being a renewable energy user, while supporting all the miners, and there's a large number, whose livelihoods would otherwise be completely destroyed by that transition at very high speed, and help them retrain into new jobs, into jobs in sustainable and all of the renewable sector. So that's the just bit and the energy bit, but the transition is fast. It needs quite a lot of developed country finance and help to the South Africans to do it, to make that work worldwide. And that's a great example, I think, of the sorts of partnerships that we're developing to make sure that all countries can decarbonize.
Wow, that's so interesting. Yeah, I had no idea about so much of what you're talking about. It's so fascinating. So what do you think the UK's role is then? So building those partnerships, are we doing anything else in that space?
I can't even do justice to the sheer amount we're doing. It does feel like. So we really did, and I'm still very proud of what all the UK teams did at COP26. It was a humongous operation. It was in the middle of COVID. It was incredibly hard to run, and we did it successfully. And we got people, you know, pretty well every world leader was here, and enormous teams that came in and out of the UK. All went really well. The negotiations were pretty brutal, but we succeeded. We managed to crack a whole bunch of negotiations that had not been cracked for a very long time. Core elements of the rule book. For the real runs around, you know, whether I spend my time on things like Article 6, which is elements of carbon markets and so on. So there is, you know, we really cracked that well. And we are continuing working pretty well in all those areas. Since we were COP presidency, we can't do everything in exactly the same way because we're not the presidency anymore. But we're still working hugely on adaptation. We're doing huge amounts of work on mitigation, but putting less government money into that because of the economic changes. In a sense, it makes commercial sense that we don't need to pump prime or top slice off risk of any of the things that we did in the early days of the technology, because so much the private sector is doing that. Adaptation, as I've said, is the place probably where we're going to really lean in, I think. And we've done a lot of this. We run a great example. There's a program run by the African Development Bank and the Global Centre on Adaptation, which is in the Netherlands, called the African Adaptation Accelerator Partnership. And when the Foreign Secretary James cleverly announced at COP27, I think we're putting £200 million into that. And what that really does, and I'm going to come to your point on frontline communities in a second, because this links. What that really does is try to get many African countries to accelerate their adaptation planning. But that's not actually something that's done at very much a government level. It's done, as I said, you know, each community thinking, well, I'm going to build a school. Now, my school could be here, but that patch of hillside in 20 years' time is going to be very hot. You can literally say it's going to be 4 degrees hotter than that patch of hillside. So we're going to build a school there instead. Well, I'm going to have to, you know, protect this spring because water use is going to be difficult. So I'm going to have more storage or more efficient use or whatever it is. This is the real climate adaptation that will make a giant difference to people's lives. So on all of adaptation, frontline communities are absolutely key. There's a kind of principle that's called locally led adaptation. And I think you're going to hear a lot more about that over the next years, because unless we can get every community, pretty well every householder, every farmer, every small business to think more about climate adaptation, we're not going to make the adaptation in the most smooth and cost-effective way, because it'll come after disasters. And disasters, as we've seen in Pakistan with the floods, as we've seen over this whole summer with incredible temperatures and the shocking disaster in Libya, for example, That is a very bad way, just from a humanitarian point of view, but also an economic point of view, for people to make change. Those are all things that can be changed in advance. The other thing I think the UK will always have a very strong role is on the whole nature agenda. We've got some of the great institutions of the world, the Kew Gardens or Royal Zoological Society or Natural History Museum. Some of the great science expertise in the UK. We've got really strong social political support for that. Just look at how important nature is. We've got a couple of utterly iconic people on this, like David Attenborough, the King, who have led this for a long time. So there's something about the role the UK can play on nature, which we have been doing and I think we'll continue to do. Because it's the third and really crucial part of all of this. Zach Goldsmith used to say there are no climate solutions without a nature solution. I think he's right. If we deforest everywhere, there are no climate solutions possible. And this links into other areas. You've probably heard about something called the Global Biodiversity Framework and to really come in Montreal. Another great mound of acronyms, but underlying all that is a real international commitment to protect and mend biodiversity. So all of these link together, and I think in that area, biodiversity and nature, the UK has had and will have a really major role.
Perfect. I'm so glad you mentioned nature. That's where my interest mainly lies. So I'm so glad that we are continuing to work on that. And even though it's not a main theme for this year's COP, I'm sure that you will focus on that.
Actually, it's going to be a pretty big thing. I think we're going to have a Forests and Climate Leaders Partnership meeting in COP. That was when we set up at COP26. It's expanded. Lots of other countries have joined it. It has some pretty stretching goals on forest and climate leaders. You can tell it all together. And the whole forestry side is beginning to move. First of all, because countries like Brazil are now protecting their forest land as they won't. So deforestation rates have just come down. And when you look at the really great forests of the world, the Amazon, Indonesia, and the Congo Basin, they're all really alive to the fact that they need to be protected and enhanced. The money is moving into that as well. So things like how do you do the paying for ecosystem services? How do you value biodiversity? That's why Kunming Montreal was really important. The importance of indigenous peoples comes through really loud and clear there as the kind of custodians of lots of these lands. And the final thing, which frankly is, I think, going to be even more important in the future, is the technologies of this. I should have worn a T-shirt for this that a friend gave me, which is made of wood. And it's incredibly comfortable. For those of you who've got bamboo socks or bamboo underwear, it's even better. But it's literally treated wood made into cloth, fantastically comfy. It has a great advantage that, first of all, it's completely sustainable. Secondly, it doesn't shed microplastics. So you can do many things in one way. And it's, as the technology develops, it's going to be cheap. You can substitute in the right ways the steel that goes into a skyscraper with a treated wood. You can build car panels out of wood. Now, all these things are kind of commercial. They're in the process of real commercialization now. So it's not sort of complete fantasy. But I think we're going to be seeing the trends towards the use of different materials as the technologies develop, which are much lower carbon, or even their best, they're negative carbon, because they sequester carbon for a very, very long time. And I think that's where I say it's not all about pure tree hugging, much as I'm of many tree huggers. It is also about the commercialization and the economic activity that then comes out of that. So if there's one figure which I think we should be watching, it's the amount of degraded land in the world. There are hundreds of thousands of hectares of degraded land, over-farmed, over-whatever, and will be really badly affected by climate. But if we restore those. You restore so many things at the same time, from biodiversity to the livelihoods, and can produce whole new industries into the bargain. So I get very excited, as you can tell, by that opportunity.
As do I. And you mentioned fishing slightly, but it needs to happen in the marine environment as well. which the UK are definitely working in as well.
Yeah. One of the things I did in my other bit of the job is responsible for the overseas territories. One of the most wonderful things we have is our blue belt. And all the work that we're doing on marine conservation much more broadly, as well as the research. But that, you're absolutely right, that is another very, very major strand of work, not least because we're really beginning to understand more and more the interlinkages, which the climate scientists have been pointing out for a while, between what happens in the ocean, what happens in the atmosphere, and then what happens on land.
Yeah, it's all interlinked. Everything affects everything else, definitely. Just going back to COP a bit. So this year it's being hosted by the UAE, and we all know that they're a fossil fuel state. So how does that pose, what difficulties does that pose, do you think?
I think it poses a political challenge for many. We've seen protests against that, and a lot of people who are deep in the climate world, I think, would say that the countries who are relying on for their primary economic development on fossil fuels are really hard to deal with. I mean, there is a natural antagonism between people saying, get rid of the thing that's actually made you rich, and the countries saying, hang on, I can't do that fast. They are a necessary part of the solution here. And the UAE have done some remarkable things, as of the Saudis, as of many other countries, about diversifying. They all, I mean, just to take those two, they have enormous investment funds for a reason. They're investing in other countries and other technologies so that they are still economically growing and viable, even when they are no longer going to be pumping oil. They can all see that the end of oil, the end of fossil fuels is coming, and they're getting themselves ready for that. But we will need all countries to be doing that, including the ones for whom oil is a really big part of their balance sheet. So, it's going to be politically, I think, difficult. I think for some of them, it's quite emotionally challenging to go and think, this is a country that's really made its money on pumping out oil, and we don't like oil, and we don't see the end of oil stop. But if what we're really looking for here is the outcome, the impact, you know, the stuff that is good civil servants we want to measure. What do we want? We want fossil fuel use to go hugely down over the next couple of decades. But we don't want to bankrupt whole countries and peoples in the process, because that is both unnegotiable and probably immoral. So we want economies, and their economies have to change probably as much or even more than ours. Their have to change. And we have to work with them to make that change happen as fast as possible. And the UAE are really interesting on this, because Dr. Sultan, who's the president and running a lot of the COP28 work, is also the chair of ADNOC, their national oil company, and he's the chair of their biggest renewable company as well. So fascinating to watch him navigate. You can see the tensions, and he does so brilliantly. And I think, as I said at the beginning, the energy companies in the tent participating, making the change that we're going to have to see, is a fundamentally good and necessary thing if we're going to actually decarbonize our entire economies.
Yeah, that's so interesting. The whole world needs to change. And I suppose with these countries hosting COP, it only becomes kind of front and center of the agenda as well, doesn't it, when they've got that responsibility.
Mm.
Perfect. Okay, well, I think we're coming to the end of our time now. And we usually end this call with a call to action. So this is going out to civil servants across the UK. So do you have any message you'd like to send to them, or a call for action you'd like them to do?
Can I have two?
Of course.
I mean, the first is a kind of more contextual, maybe. The changes that are coming are probably going to come faster than we can, not faster than we want, but faster than we think they're going to happen. This energy transition feels like it is really major. We've shown that actually energy transitions can happen remarkably quickly. I mean, look at the kind of decarbonisation in the UK and other countries have shown how much you can cut, how much you can decouple that from GDP growth. So I think my call on that one is realise this is coming faster than you probably have in the back of your mind is going to happen, and get with it, plan for it, make it work. The second is I get a bit frustrated sometimes about sort of, you know, climate leadership as a concept. I'm not quite sure. I think we're on that. Most every country is going to be on a different path. So as long as we're all essentially understand that the goal here is net zero. The goal is keeping below 1.5. Some countries will take longer, like India's NDC takes them to net zero about 2070. It may not take them that long, but that's an NDC, and they're on a different path. Others are going to be quicker. I think some countries will decarbonize remarkably quickly. But all around the world, community after community, and in the most unlikely places, I see incredible examples of innovation, best practice, and so on. So my second call is, we don't know what we're doing in the UK. We've got some brilliant examples here, but we certainly don't have all of them. So get out and look at what other countries, other civil servants, other businesses around the world are doing. Because there's a remarkable amount of ferment of innovation and thought going on in this. And I think it's brilliant to get out and listen to it, what's in other countries. This is the perfect example where the domestic and the international are so intertwined, you really can't separate them. Just as I think climate and energy and environment are so intertwined, you just can't separate them. You have to deal with them as kind of whole balls of wax.
Wow, yeah. So we've got to kind of pull our bootstraps up, like be aware of the speed and just try and work with it and get out and learn. That's perfect. Cool. Well, thanks so much, BJ, for talking to us today. I'm sure we could talk to you for hours. You're full of insights and knowledge in this area. So thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure. Love to come back at some point. Maybe after COP28, we can do something all on the ramp. So I tell you, we'll be at COP, so we can always continue the conversation. It should be great.
Yeah, fabulous. And thanks very much for you at home for listening. Goodbye.
Thanks all. Bye.
We hope you've enjoyed this environment deep dive. You can head to CSUN online for more content, events, and networking opportunities. Make sure to subscribe to us on Twitter, YouTube, and your favorite podcast app so you can keep an eye out for new episodes coming soon.